Welcome to the WebMD Health Discovered podcast. I'm Dr. Neha Pathak, WebMD's Chief Physician Editor for Health and Lifestyle Medicine. Today, we're exploring gallstones, gallbladder removal, and what people need to know about nutrition and lifestyle choices after gallbladder surgery. More than 1 million Americans are diagnosed with gallstones every year, and women at all ages are more likely than men to develop gallstones. These stones occur in nearly 25% of women in the United States by age 60, and as many as 50% of women by age 75. Today, we're going to take a step-by-step approach to gallbladder health and explore what function the gallbladder serves, how are gallstones formed, what are the signs and symptoms, and what does that mean for our overall health. Gallbladder problems can be really uncomfortable, but understanding the options available is the first step to finding relief. Here to walk us through this topic is our guest, Dr. Benjamin Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt is a board-certified gastroenterologist. He's the creator of a popular YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok platform, Doc Schmidt, where he shares comedic healthcare-themed videos aiming to entertain and educate. Welcome to the WebMD Health Discovered podcast, Dr. Schmidt.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So I am very, very excited to jump into our topic for today. But before I do, I'd love to ask about your health discovery and your own personal aha moment, particularly around this intersection of gastroenterology and social media. How did you come to it? And what was the big aha for you?
Sure. I think some of it was a happy accident with the way that the world was at the time that I started doing this, being in the midst of the pandemic. But for me, I kind of recognized that GI in particular is a field that has a lot of breadth to it. A lot of different diseases fit within that. And there's a lot in pop culture where people are trying to learn as much as they can about their bodies and their gut health in particular. And with the kind of era of TikTok and everyone wanting to get on social media and have an opinion and have a voice, there was unfortunately a lot of misinformation about the world of GI in terms of supplements, in terms of different ways to maximize your gut health. So it seemed like a really good combination for me to try to use my gastroenterology knowledge from my medical training, combined with some experience I have from when I was younger of making videos, to try to dispel myths that are out there and kind of educate about what doctors are, what doctors can do, what doctors are like, and all along the way, kind of dispelling myths about gut health and trying to educate. So it's been a fun journey to try to spread that knowledge as much as I can.
Well, thank you for joining us today so we can do some education around gallstones.
Absolutely. I'm excited to get started.
So let's start with just describing what the gallbladder is and what does it do when it's functioning properly.
Sure, absolutely. The gallbladder at its core is really just a small sac that sits just underneath your liver. And its main function is honestly just holding extra bile. Bile is a substance that the body uses to help digest foods, in particular fats. Bile is not made by the gallbladder. It's made in the liver. And then there's a connection from the gallbladder to the main bile ducts. And all the extra bile that we don't need at any given moment is sent to the gallbladder to just kind of hold in place for whenever we eat a big meal or a very fatty meal where a lot of extra bile might be needed. And then the gallbladder can excrete that extra bile and it moves down the bile duct into the small intestine and starts interacting with that food that you've eaten to break it down and help you digest more effectively.
So then let's talk through what happens when things start to go wrong with that process. Particularly what most people have heard about is the gallstone. If you think about your gallbladder at all, you're generally thinking about it because of gallstones. So can you talk us through how gallstones develop and how do you recognize that that might be a problem for you?
Absolutely. So gallstones, there's actually a couple of different types of gallstones, but the most common one, the most famous one are called cholesterol stones. It's normal for your bile to have cholesterol in it. There's a lot of different chemicals, bile salts, cholesterol are probably the two greatest compounds from a proportion standpoint. But what can happen sometimes is the balance of the cholesterol and the bile acids gets out of whack, for lack of a better phrase. And if there's too much cholesterol in the bile, then what can happen is that the bile no longer remains a liquid and the cholesterol kind of comes out of solution and crystallizes, if you will. And that is really what a classic gallstone is. It's that bile is starting to harden and become an actual solid object. And that can happen for a lot of different reasons. But one potential reason is if the bile, for whatever reason, is not moving as well as it should. Normally, bile kind of hangs out in the gallbladder and then is periodically excreted and sent along to your intestine to help digest. But if the bile isn't moving as well, that kind of predisposes stones to form. There's also other types of stones that are less common, like a black pigment stone is one that occurs as a result of all the blood products that happen from something called hemolysis, which is when your red blood cells rupture. Without getting too into the weeds, that's essentially a product of a lot of different diseases. But if you have a disease that causes blood cells to rupture periodically, those kind of byproducts of the ruptured blood cell can then in turn increase the risk of a new type of stone forming, that being the black pigmented stone.
So thanks for kind of helping us break down the different types of gallstones, the most common being the cholesterol one. So what are some of the risk factors that might put you at higher risk for developing those types of gallstones relative to somebody who's not going to develop that? Does it have something to do with the amount of cholesterol in your diet, or what are some of the other risk factors that we need to be thinking about?
Having a increased cholesterol level doesn't necessarily increase your risk because it's more about the balance of the cholesterol. But certainly people that are overweight or obese definitely have an increased risk of getting gallstones. There's a few other characteristics that we kind of watch for. Being female is certainly a risk factor compared to being male. Your risk of getting gallstones is actually pretty substantially higher. People of childbearing age are more likely to. People over 40 in general are going to have a higher risk of having gallstones as well. There's also some ethnicity. Native Americans actually have a higher likelihood of getting gallstones. So those are some just about patient demographics that can increase your risk. And then with regards to the other types of stones, of course, if you have a disease that makes you more likely to have hemolysis or breaking up of your blood vessels, then you're going to be much more likely to get those types of stones that form as a result of those broken up blood cells, rather.
So let's say you're to the point where you are potentially in one of those high-risk categories, maybe not, but you'd start developing certain types of symptoms. What's a red flag for you that gallstones is something that you need to be thinking about?
The most famous symptom and the most common symptom of gallstones is abdominal pain, and more specifically, right upper quadrant abdominal pain, the right upper portion of your belly. And that most commonly will happen if the pain is due to gallstones. It'll be a pain that typically comes on after eating, and more commonly after eating a fattier meal, like fast food, for example, or something like that. And that pain is a result of the gallstones that are sitting in your bile duct trying to get out of your gallbladder, because the gallbladder is typically excreting bile whenever you're eating to try to digest your food. And those stones can't get out. And the pressure from the gallbladder trying to push out those stones is going to cause a lot of pain. As that pain builds, sometimes it can cause nausea or vomiting as well.
Can you talk us through sort of like the different range of symptoms and what progression might look like?
There is definitely a spectrum in terms of both severity of symptoms and likelihood whether symptoms are going to kind of come back. Because as I alluded to, the symptoms start once you have stones that are kind of stuck when they're trying to get pushed out of the gallbladder. And while it is possible that it could be a one-time episode of pain, or if you pass the gallstone and it does make its way out of the gallbladder, that you may never have any issues. The recommendation is as soon as you have symptoms from gallstones, like this type of pain, for example, then it's recommended to have your gallbladder removed, because once you have gallstone pain once, the recurrence rate is high. And furthermore, the likelihood or the possibility that these gallstones are going to cause further complications beyond just causing pain from their attempted exit of the gallbladder, that risk is high as well. We can kind of get into that as we go along. But since there's multiple potential complications and unfortunately an unpredictable but definite risk of recurrence of these symptoms, that usually forces our hand in terms of our recommendation for how to deal with these stones.
So first, someone comes into your office. Let's go down that track first. Someone comes into your office, they're giving you a story that's really consistent with gallstones. What are you going to do for them?
So the first thing is to determine whether gallstones are present. And the good news is we can do that with a relatively simple imaging test called an ultrasound, where we look specifically at the liver and the gallbladder with what's called a right upper quadrant ultrasound, because that's the area where the gallbladder sits in the belly. And that test doesn't require any radiation, doesn't require any dye. and it can very quickly and very accurately tell us if there's gallstones in your gallbladder. That test can also tell us if there's signs that your gallbladder is infected or that there's other abnormalities, but typically what we're looking for to confirm is whether gallstones are present. And if they are, then that leads us to the next step of saying whether we think this pain that you're experiencing or these symptoms that you're experiencing are due to those gallstones or not. And if we think that is the case, the gallstones that we now know are in your gallbladder due to the ultrasound result, if your pain is consistent with a gallbladder type of pain based on the pattern of pain, based on the location of pain, then typically I would recommend a visit with a surgeon to discuss further steps and consider having the gallbladder removed to reduce likelihood of either continued pain episodes or further complications of those gallstones.
Let's talk about that track then, in terms of the further complications. Can you talk us through what some of those complications might be and who might be at more risk for some of those further complications?
Absolutely. The thing about gallstones is that they're not really supposed to be anywhere. They're not supposed to be in the gallbladder, certainly, but the benefit that you have is that the gallbladder is a pretty big structure relative to the size of the gallstones. So you might get a little pain, but often the gallstones can sit there and not cause much more than pain. The problem really begins when the gallstones get out of the gallbladder, ironically, because once they're out of the gallbladder, then the gallstones are suddenly in the bile duct, which the bile duct is a very narrow structure and is not intended to carry stones or anything solid. Its only purpose is really to move the liquid bile down from either the gallbladder or the liver to the intestines to help digest your food. But what will commonly happen is if a stone ends up in there, is that stone will pretty quickly get stuck because it's too big for that bile duct. And what can happen there is you can get a very serious infection that's called cholangitis that really comes from that stone getting stuck. And whenever there's a blockage in the human body, bacteria love to kind of hang out behind that blockage since there's no longer any movement of liquids or any problems like that. So they can feast on the bile, which is a very nutrient-rich substance. They can grow and cause a severe, severe infection that can be life-threatening ultimately. If you're lucky and it continues to move down, the other place it can get blocked is at the pancreatic duct. The pancreas feeds its juices to help with digestion into a very similar location just at the bile ducts. And if a stone gets lodged there, those pancreatic juices will get backed up and that'll inflame the pancreas and you can get something called pancreatitis. I would say those are probably the two most common complications. And really the main risk factor for getting those complications is having gallstones in your gallbladder. There aren't necessarily specific additional demographic risks. If you're at risk for getting gallstones, then you're at risk for getting these complications sort of by association.
So someone comes in to your office, they complain about these types of symptoms periodically, you check ultrasound, you see the gallstones versus that person who's in a lot of pain because the stone is stuck in one of the ducts. Can you talk through just the urgency of what intervention means and what types of interventions are you thinking about based on what you're seeing?
The degree of intervention certainly depends on what complication you're getting from the gallstones, as you alluded to. If we just think that you have gallstones that are hanging out in the gallbladder and they're intermittently getting stuck at the end of the gallbladder and causing some pain, that's the least urgent, but it's still a situation where I would recommend that within the next few months, you at least talk to a surgeon about getting the gallbladder removed so that we reduce the risk of these more significant complications developing. The other complication that I didn't specifically describe is if a stone is trying to get out of the gallbladder and gets stuck for a prolonged amount of time, again, bacteria can grow in that clogged up gallbladder and cause an infection of the gallbladder directly. That's a little bit more serious than just gallstones getting blocked, not quite as serious as a bile duct itself getting blocked up. If you have an infection of the gallbladder, often that results in you getting hospitalized for antibiotics and for monitoring. And usually it's recommended that you have the gallbladder removed on the scale of days. And if you have the complication where your bile duct gets blocked by a stone, like if a stone gets out of the gallbladder, gets into the bile duct and gets stuck, and an infection develops, that's cholangitis. If that develops, that's a much more urgent issue. That's something that really needs to be dealt with within 1 to 2 days, if not sooner, just because of the risk of the infection that can develop as an association. For a lot of these complications, or for all of them, the ultimate solution is to remove the gallbladder and the stones with it. But in the specific example of a stone being stuck in the bile duct, that needs an additional procedure to be done first. And that's a procedure done by a GI doctor like myself that's called an ERCP. Which is a variation on a typical upper endoscopy. many people may have had an upper endoscopy before to look for ulcers or to look for causes of heartburn, for example. That's where a camera is put down the mouth to look into the stomach and the small intestine. But this procedure, the ERCP, is a little bit more advanced because you do the same initial scope to go all the way down into the small intestine, and you get to the point where normally the bile duct spits out bile into the small intestine, and we can actually go backwards and look up from the small intestine into the bile duct and use tools to pull the stuck stone out of the bile duct and just pull it into the small intestine so it can be digested normally and passed through the stool. But surgeons can't as readily remove the stone from the bile duct without increasing the risk of the procedure. So it's much safer if your stone is specifically stuck in the bile duct to have a GI doctor do this ERCP procedure to remove the stone first. And once we're confident that there's no more stone stuck in the bile duct itself, then a surgeon, typically within a day or two often, can remove the gallbladder itself and any remaining stones, essentially to eliminate the risk of further gallbladder complications.
What do you have to do in terms of follow-up after a gallbladder surgery? What does care look like? What does digestion look like after you've had your gallbladder removed?
Typically, in many cases, care can be pretty abbreviated. You're naturally going to have one or two post-op visits with your surgeon immediately after the procedure. That's, you know, on the scale of within weeks after the procedure. That's more to look for signs of infection at the surgical site and make sure that everything is healed up. But for many people, that can be pretty close to sufficient in terms of follow-up. The issue comes in more if you have kind of more longer-term effects from no longer having a gallbladder. The most famous one of those is having chronic diarrhea from having a gallbladder removed, which we can certainly talk more about. And that's something that if symptoms develop, then those can be followed by a gastroenterologist like myself. But you don't necessarily need routine follow-up with a gastroenterologist or a surgeon long-term after having a gallbladder removed. Most people tolerate it very well and do not have long-term consequences that require monitoring from a doctor.
And how do you counsel your patients about what this change in digestion may look like? Is it even something that they might even notice aside from the diarrhea you said that it seems like more of a rare complication, but someone who's having these fatty meals, they no longer have a gallbladder. Is that the feeling of digesting that meal going to be very similar to someone who had no problem with their gallbladder?
I think that's getting at the biggest change in someone who has their gallbladder removed. And hopefully this is often part of the just simple counseling both before and immediately after the surgeon removes the gallbladder, is that there is a recommendation to alter your diet following gallbladder removal, precisely because the main role the gallbladder plays is being able to help us in digesting foods or meals that are particularly high in fat, because we use bile to help digest fat. So the amount of bile that the liver is making is certainly bile that we can use, but it's often not enough when we have a large meal, a fatty meal that needs extra bile. And typically that's where the gallbladder comes in. It has this store of extra bile that we can use to break up and help digest these fattier meals. So without a gallbladder, if you have a very fatty meal, you'll still have some bile coming from the liver to help break that down and digest it, but you probably won't have enough. And as a result of that, whenever fat remains in the gut undigested, not properly digested, that fat kind of causes a very unpleasant diarrhea and kind of a bloating and a very foul-smelling stool. So people, if they either weren't counseled properly or if they were counseled on avoiding fatty meals and maybe you forgot that recommendation, they'll often learn it very quickly, because the result of eating a fatty meal when you don't have a gallbladder can often be very unpleasant in that it can cause diarrhea, foul-smelling stool, and kind of cramping and discomfort because of the undigested fat that remains in their stool as it moves through the colon.
Any supplements or any other information that patients should be aware of after a gallbladder removal?
For me, the most important thing is just to be aware of the risk that sometimes even changing your diet in the ways that are recommended, kind of along the lines of what I just alluded to, will still result in some people having chronic diarrhea. And just knowing that there is that risk, and in that event, then following up with a GI doctor would be recommended to help manage those symptoms. In terms of supplements, the short answer is no. There's a lot of gallbladder supplements out there from different healthcare professionals, but most of them, if you look into it, are not doctors, because there are no medical recommendations for gallbladder supplements after you've had your gallbladder removed, precisely because it's not that the gallbladder normally is making bile, it's just storing extra bile. So there's no function that you're losing out on by not having a gallbladder other than simply the inability to store extra bile. So there are not specific supplements that are needed. Sometimes if you have chronic diarrhea from your gallbladder removal, that can result in some of your electrolytes, for instance, being thrown off. But that's not something that you would need to supplement yourself. That's more of just a sign that you need to follow up with a GI doctor to try to work through how to get this diarrhea better controlled.
What bite-sized action item would you like to share with the audience or any final thought that I haven't asked you about?
I think for me, I see a lot of patients in my GI clinic who have had their gallbladder removed already as a result of an attempt to treat vague symptoms that they're experiencing, be that nausea, be that some vomiting, be that some abdominal pain. And I think an important question, if you're in a position where your doctor is recommending having a gallbladder removed, is to ask the doctor how confident they are that the symptoms that you're experiencing are from your gallbladder. And maybe that seems like a silly question to ask, but unfortunately, a lot of times GI symptoms can be very vague and very ambiguous. So sometimes we tend towards removing the gallbladder because it's something we know we can do and we know is straightforward. But sometimes some doctors are doing that without full confidence that that's going to be the solution for the symptoms or knowing that that's the best next step. So I think getting an idea of how confident the doctor is in the necessity of the gallbladder removal and not being afraid to get a second opinion if there is some lack of confidence. And then I think the other thing is just remembering that you don't automatically need a gallbladder supplement just because you've had your gallbladder removed. There's a lot of people out there that are more than willing to sell you a supplement if you are interested, and they'll try to convey an importance towards that. But there's nothing suggesting a need for any sort of supplement automatically. And I think if there's any ambiguity based on symptoms you're experiencing and thoughts you might need one, I think the best step is to talk to a doctor rather than going on Amazon or going online and trying to automatically just buy a supplement without consulting with a medical professional.
That's really great information. Thank you so much, Dr. Schmidt. Really appreciate your time. We've talked with Dr. Schmidt about the importance of personalizing your care with your healthcare professional. Regardless of the types of symptoms you're having, it's always important to share that information with your healthcare professional, get the next best steps to evaluate what could be going on, and make sure that you are working in close conjunction with your healthcare provider to get the care that you need. To find out more about Dr. Benjamin Schmidt, visit docschmidt.org, and you can find him on Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok for more educational content. And we'll have information about how to connect with him in our show notes. Thank you so much for listening. Please take a moment to follow, rate, and review this podcast on your favorite listening platform. If you'd like to send me an email about topics you're interested in or questions for future guests, please send me a note at webmdpodcast@webmd.net. This is Dr. Neha Pathak for the WebMD Health Discovered Podcast.